Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. If I'm not mistaken, this is episode number 792. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, the Reformed Forum HQ, and I'm happy to have with me two brothers in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Let me introduce to you first the esteemed Dr. Daryl Hart, D.G. Hart, of course, knower and author of all things, J. Gresson Machen. He's a professor at Hillsdale College over in Hillsdale, Michigan. Welcome back, Daryl. So good to have you back today.
Thanks, Camden. It's good to be with you and your next guest.
Yes, sir. We also have with us Danny Olinger, who serves as the General Secretary for the OPC's Committee on Christian Education. And of course, co-host, co-partner with me in this new series on Machen's Christianity and Liberalism. Welcome back, Danny. It's good to see you today, too.
Hey, thanks, Ken. I'm glad to be here.
Well, sorry to downgrade you, Danny, to a guest instead of co-host. I apologize.
No problem.
I got a couple things to mention. We have begun this series. This is, our podcast, Christ the Center. However, we do often these little sub-series within this main program. So we have our Voss group that we've been doing for 10 years about. Lane Tipton and I have been working through pages of Voss's book, Biblical Theology. And we've been working through that once a month, once every 2 months. We also have maybe about four or five times a year do our Van Til group. But because this is the 100th anniversary of the publication of Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism, we thought it'd be nice to devote some extra time to the book leading up to, we hope, the General Assembly of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church in June 23. So looking back 100 years now of Machen's Christianity and Liberalism, we're focusing on that. Last time, Danny and I got together and talked about the preface, which is interesting, the circumstances that gave rise to the book to begin with, as well as the introduction. And today we're going to be turning to the second chapter, which actually is the chapter on doctrine. And in future weeks, we're going to be looking at this book and discussing subsequent chapters with a whole range of other guests as well. So I'm working on scheduling those and having a wonderful cast of characters to come on and talk about the things of Machen. So we have that going on, but let me introduce and explain a few other things that we have. Just this morning, I listened to the second episode of the Ruling Elder podcast from the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. I mentioned that to Danny already. Danny's the general secretary who oversees the work of this committee on Christian education. Daryl's a member of that committee as well. Although, Daryl, I'm not sure which subcommittee you're on, whether podcasts are your purview or not, but you're becoming a king of podcasts. So I figure that you have the expertise to provide oversight. So if there are ruling elders in this land, are you a ruling podcaster? I think so. So anyway, this podcast is tremendous. It really is wonderful. I've listened to both episodes. The first one, Stephen Tracy, the host, is a minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. He interviewed Craig Troxell, the president of the committee, or the chairman. I don't know what title you guys prefer. But he spoke about ruling elders, their importance, their significance. And in the second episode, several people, including Danny, talk about their experience with ruling elders and the importance therein. So it's a wonderful, it's about 25 minutes per episode and a tremendous resource. Several years ago, I was thinking we needed to be doing something for ruling elders here at Reform Forum. And I'm glad now I don't have to, because the proper committee, the proper committee is doing this work. And I think it's going to be very, very helpful. Danny, I don't know if you have anything to add or want to mention anything, or Daryl, about this and maybe any future plans.
Yeah, we're very excited. Stephen Tracy is doing a great job, and we're really looking forward to it in that it's untapped. Mm-hmm. We're really going to try to talk about things that I think are rare and yet so very needed in regard to the life of the church.
I appreciate that. I'll definitely include a link to the podcast in the episode description so people can subscribe. You can subscribe to it wherever podcasts are found. And make sure that you get every episode downloaded automatically to your device or just listen online. That's great. That's really great. There's also a whole bunch of other podcasts the OPC's putting out, one for deacons as well. So find out about those things or write in at mail@reformforum.org if you have any questions or suggestions. We'll be sure to pass them along. Well, today we're talking, as I mentioned earlier, about Christianity and Liberalism by J. Gresham Machen. And I have my 24 copy here, my 23 copies in the other room. I don't bring that one out. It's not under glass, but it's close to it. This one here, lovely little copy, but most of the copies that are out there, other than Westminster's latest one, are, you know, reprints of the original. They have the same pagination. So if we mention any specific pages and whatnot in the book, you'll probably have a copy that will match and follow along. This book, written in 23 and the beginnings of starting to heat up the Presbyterian conflict, and there's a lot to discuss. And if you want to learn more about this history and the background, and specifically Machen's fight against liberalism from an historical perspective, we'll get into details today, but you can also take Daryl's course on J. Gresham Machen and the Presbyterian conflict. Daryl, I don't even know if I've told you, but we've since put your course entirely on YouTube as a YouTube playlist. So it's not only available on our website, wow, but we've, in addition to that, it's always been available for free, but in addition to that, we've just this last, just a few days ago, released the course as a YouTube playlist. So now you're going to earn extra cred, street cred, with my kids, because they don't care about anything I do. They don't care that I'm a minister of the gospel per se. Well, they care, but they don't think that's a big deal. What they really care about is that my face is on some YouTube videos. So there you go. You're all set. You can find that course online at reformedforum.org, or you can also head over to youtube.com/reformedforum to register. Now, you don't even need to register if you're watching on YouTube, but to hit the playlist and take the course. I don't know if either of you have watched many. Daryl, you were there. You taught it. But this was a really excellent course for Sunday school. So I'm hoping that every OPC would look into this. And we've made it about as easy as possible. We can even send you a thumb drive if you want the files. But for a small group or for an adult Sunday school course, or if you just want to learn at home, these lessons are roughly 30 minutes. We have accompanying resources, handouts, discussion questions, all available for free. And you get to follow along with Machen's fight against a whole variety of things. Daryl explains all that in the course, explains how he structured the course. But Daryl, I just want to maybe take a public moment to commend you in that course. And maybe thanks. Ask you if you've received any feedback from anyone. We need to get people to take this thing.
On Twitter I have, mm-hmm, for sure, and it comes in waves. So usually related to when you're tweeting about
when
it.
When I'm pumping it.
But yeah, I'll get included on that, on the discussion. But yeah, that's gotten good. Some.
It's good. I think.
Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.
I had the opportunity to listen to them all, and it just reinforced what Charlie Dennison thought of Daryl 30 years ago. And Charlie said Daryl
better
was,
than what Chip Stonehouse thought of Daryl.
Yes, thought that Daryl was the greatest living Machen scholar, and that we had a real treasure in the work he was doing on Machen, and that the class to me just reaffirmed that. And the scholarship, it's like the first time you read Defending the Faith, Daryl's book. It's like, wow. And then to hear the class, I can't recommend it enough also for the Sunday school.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I concur.
Well, I think that's very kind to hear that. And I'm glad to have done it. And Camden did compensate me nicely for it. But I have to say, I was still working with a great subject. So mm-hmm, to have Machen as the person to explore was still... I don't get tired of going back to him.
Yeah. Yeah. He certainly warrants multiple reads, meditation, contemplation. He's such a significant figure. And I think sometimes we might be Orthodox Presbyterians, especially those who research and write about and talk about him, sometimes get accused of various degrees of hagiography. But certainly, I think everyone must agree that he's a significant figure and needs to be reckoned with. Daryl, well, all three of us have attended at least the last couple years the Presbyterian Scholars Conference in Wheaton. And it's really an interesting group of people because we have everyone from OPC guys to mainline people. And even the mainline people certainly have a different view of who Machen's theology, but they certainly recognize his significance. Yeah. Has that been the case, Daryl? Have you noticed any shifts over, you know, since you were back at Johns Hopkins thinking about and writing about Machen? I mean, has the collective consciousness about Machen and his warrior children grown, or is this something that's been evident even from the very beginning?
I mean, I guess I'm still struck by the men who I regard highly, men like Mark Knoll, George Marsden, and that era of historical scholarship about evangelicalism, but beyond that. I mean, I think their take on Machen, which was really good stuff, Christianity liberalism, but he went too far with Westminster and the OPC. So there's a kind of sectarian element to Machen that they regard as you know, and I think it is the case, and I've argued this, that it doesn't fit well with neo-evangelicalism or later evangelicalism. And it's not as if they were all in on evangelicalism, but they were writing about it appreciatively, criticizing, correcting, but trying to hope for something better of evangelicalism. So, you know, I guess I was kind of taking Machen, the way I was interpreting Machen, I was kind of taking Machen away from that mix. And I certainly was in a way doing that. I think the sources pointed in that direction, but still, and it fit more with my own inclinations about evangelicalism more generally, that I just didn't feel at home there. I wanted something more confessional. But I mean, I guess over the course of my career, I have felt some people in the evangelical and academic worlds have pigeonholed me in a way because of the Machen book.
Oh. As you're a denominational historian, you know, there's this category where people want to.
Or your conservative heart, like Machen is. And of course I am, but I, you know, I'm trying to do more than that as a professional, whatever that means. So, you know, I think that association with Machen, I think, comes back to me here and there. I'll give you one. You know, this is probably too much TMI for something as public as this. And I guess you don't edit these, but you could edit this out.
I can.
But I'll say it anyway. I'm going to write about it in the Nicotine Theological Journal. But I'm not annoyed. I'm only mildly annoyed. Okay, mildly. But Ligonier, in the recent table talk, has an issue dedicated to Machen and Christianity liberalism, and they didn't ask me to write.
Mm-hmm. I know.
what I'm going to reflect about, and I've been thinking about this for a while, the people who were in the seminary world, like myself, like Carl Truman, like T. David Gordon, even extending it more broadly to people like Pete Enns and Tremper Longman, there is a kind of standing you have in the church world, the parachurch world, when you're at a seminary, that in some ways you wind up giving up when you go to a liberal arts college or college environment, unless you can hit the bullseye the way Carl has with all the sex stuff and the self stuff. And I'm not trying to minimize that necessarily, but you kind of like have to hit some kind of sweet spot out there that no one else is addressing. So, I mean, and if you look at that issue of Table Talk, it's dominated by seminary folk, which is, again, understandable that Ligonier would do it this way. But
We're at least thankful that John got to write one on the church. So we're
right.
That
right.
works. But yes, I thought that was a glaring omission. The nice thing about it is that we have all the opportunity that we need to talk about things here. And, you know, you've written a tremendous amount about Machen and even Christianity and liberalism. We have a whole course available. All this stuff's available. So we can talk about that today. We're going to talk about Machen. And it's interesting, you mentioned association with Machen and the way that's been interpreted, not only by modernists or liberals, but also by people that were ostensibly or truly, but formerly, very close to him. Daryl, I want to read you a quote. I'm sure that you've come across this in the past, but maybe you've forgotten about it. Seeing that the Super Bowl just finished, we can use a good football metaphor. But right after, I should say before. So the Independent Board of Foreign Missions had been founded, and not everyone who supported Westminster Seminary, founded in 29, supported the Independent Board. So board founded in 35 or 33?
Board was founded in 33.
33, but it had been going on for a couple of years by the time this was written. So
right.
Come February 36, just after a conflict had occurred on the board of Westminster, there was a great showdown between the faculty and at least 11 members of the board. And those 11 did not approve or did not think that Machen should be pressing the envelope as he was and pushing the envelope and pressing matters, driving perhaps towards a split, towards the formation of a new church. The Independent Board existed, and Machen also had spun up something of an affinity organization, an affinity group called the Presbyterian Constitution Covenant Union, which eventually called for a meeting in June 11th, 1936, which became the First General Assembly of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Samuel Craig, I'm getting somewhere, trust me. Listeners, I know Daryl knows what I'm talking about, and so does Danny way better than I do. But this is all going to make sense. Samuel G. Craig was a board member at Westminster. He also created a new publishing company at the time, Presbyterian and Reform Publishing Company, which has been renamed PNR. I'm told the P and the R don't mean anything anymore by them, but legally it's P and R Publishing. But back then it was Presbyterian and Reformed Publishing. And Craig also created a publication, Christianity Today, which is not the same as the Christianity Today publication that you're thinking of in terms of what it does online. But Craig couldn't support Machen, didn't think he was being wise, didn't think he was going about this battle correctly, and effectively, as far as I read him, he and Clarence McCartney wanted to attempt to renew the church from within. They did not want to begin a new church. And Craig resigned with 10 others from the board of Westminster. They said to save the seminary, even though they thought it was kind of being controlled by tyrannical faculty who wasn't making good decisions. And he wrote this in an editorial in Christianity Today in February 1936. Dr. Machen is a very gifted man, but as a tactician, we venture the opinion that he is about the world's worst. If we may use a football illustration, we would say that every expert would place him on the All-America, but that not a single one would place him in the quarterback position. Daryl, you got any thoughts on that? Or what sentiment? I'm interested in this, not just because it's kind of funny, but I'm interested in this particular quote because it expresses a sentiment coming from conservative people, but conservative people who have a very different view of how to go about this fight. And that's what we're going to get into, is the nature of this fight when we start talking about doctrine here. But what's going on with Craig's comment, and what do you think, why is it important to understand this stripe of Presbyterian?
I mean, I've heard this often. I think I've read that, and it's been a while since I have read it. And this was the line taken by people who were with Machen at Westminster, but then departed, obviously. And I've often wondered, well, wait, why wasn't he a little bit headstrong to start Westminster? I mean, you were with them on that. You thought that was a pretty good move. Surely some of you could have tried to stay. I mean, Craig couldn't have tried to stay at Princeton. I don't think he had any standing. I don't know. Maybe he was on the board then. I don't know.
McCartney
recall.
Could have, though.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I've often thought if you were on board with Westminster, you pretty much should have been thinking that this could happen. The independent board, you could argue, is a real challenge, but it did also glaringly raise the difficulty of missions and what was happening on the mission field, and it illustrates the problem of liberalism. And in that sense, tactically, it was pretty smart. And in hindsight, as more scholarship comes out about Presbyterian foreign missionaries, Protestant foreign missionaries, David Hollinger, a prominent intellectual historian now retired from Berkeley, he wrote about intellectual history for most of his career, but he's taken up some work on Protestant missionaries and the way in which experience on the mission field made them more progressive, more tolerant, and the way that the children of missionaries come back to America and assume positions of leadership in government or philanthropic agencies and the like. And, you know, they have a broader experience than so your basket of deplorables in the United States. I mean, that's kind of the way the argument runs. But, you know, what he's showing is that foreign missions was just covered with humanitarian endeavors and trying to do something directly gospel oriented was very difficult. So, not to mention, and I mean, the more I've studied U.S. history and foreign policy, the more I think Machen is probably not fully aware of the repercussions, but he was politically savvy. I mean, about civil politics and his views about America's foreign footprint in foreign policy diverged from the mainstream in some respects, although it's still emerging what America's role in the world is going to be in the 1930s. But, you know, Michael Duran gave a lecture under First Things auspices about 5 years ago now, connecting the dots between foreign policy and religion or theology. And he doesn't bring up Machen in that essay, but he does bring up Bryan. And he contrasts Bryan's kind of populism and the foreign policy implications of that with Ernest Hocking, who writes the report, Rethinking Missions, The Layman's Inquiry, who was a Harvard philosophy professor. And you really do have a kind of Jacksonian versus Wilsonian foreign policy playing out, or even Trumpian versus the blob that Duran himself is thinking about when he's giving this lecture in 2017. And from that angle, from that kind of hindsight, it looks to me like Craig probably didn't quite get it. I mean, how Westminster has done, has fared. I mean, it's persisted. I think a dissertation waiting to be written, and maybe it has been, and I'm just unaware of it, is what did happen to the conservatives who stayed in the PCUSA? What happened? I mean, did they amount to anything? Were they able to accomplish anything? And you could look at McCartney's career in the PCUSA. You could look at Erdman, who was a kind of conservative, although opposed to Machen. You could also look at Fuller Seminary and how that played out. There are avenues to take in looking at that. But, you know, I mean, Westminster doesn't become Fuller. It doesn't become Gordon Conwell. The OPC doesn't become, I mean, what's the Reformed equivalent of, I mean, it doesn't rival the PCUSA in numbers, money, or whatever, nor does McIntyre, nor does the EPC today. I mean, it's not clear if anyone is really rivaling the institutions of the mainline. And is that the, you know, if that's the standard, I'm not sure if Machen was that unwise to get out when he did, but anyway, I've rambled on about that, but I guess what I'd like to know is find a diary of someone like on the original faculty and see what they wrote about faculty meetings the day after. And if there's any kind of innuendo or subtext that, man, Machen really is dogmatic about, he's always has to get his way. And I mean, just one last point. The thing I think that really did flip or trigger or red pill Machen was was Princeton Seminary. What happened with the reorganization? And he, the conservatives that he was aligned with in the PCUSA and at Princeton were, he was going along with their counsel. He was pretty much saying, okay, I'm going to do, going to be a team player. But Princeton was the line in the sand. And once that happened, he was finished with trying to stay within the existing structures as they were. I mean, Westminster obviously is a step out, but he's still within the church technically. The independent board is another step out, but it's still within in a way, because the people who are in the organization are in ministers, officers in the PCUSA, but then
And then the PCCU.
it's the trial that drives him out. Machen didn't leave on his own, but
Two things. One is on the immediate scene in 1934, 35 is Machen loses his right-hand man, Frank Stevenson dies. And he was definitely his backer on the board. He was the power broker. He not only had the prestige and had been on the fighting for Machen on the board at Princeton, but his I know Machen had personal wealth, but nothing like Stevenson and the Shillitoe inheritance of his wife in Cincinnati. So he lost a lot when Stevenson dies.
What year was that again? Sorry.
I think it was in 35, the very year this happens. And so basically Machen goes from Stevenson being his counsel to H. McAlister Griffiths. That was not a good exchange in any way. And he lost at every level with that. But the other thing, and listening to Daryl talk, is that the person that really comes to my mind is Robert Speer, the longtime Secretary of Foreign Missions in the Presbyterian Church. In that, I have the great privilege to go to every General Assembly as the General Secretary. And you get to meet so many people and you make so many relationships. And here is Speer doing this for 46 years. They call him when he's 24 years old. And they basically call him because he's the best recruiter of college students for the student volunteer movement. They pick him out of seminary. He's not even finished his seminary degree. He goes and does this. Well, when you read about Speer, when you read the biography by John Piper, not the conservative John Piper, but the Presbyterian John Piper, and then when you read what Brad Longfield has written about Speer, Speer really was so indifferent to doctrine. In many ways, this chapter could be written about him, this chapter on doctrine and Christian liberalism, because he just wanted to mobilize young people to evangelize the world in this generation. And so it's fascinating when you take a look at him, he actually almost pulls a Lyndon Johnson, if we're going to talk US politics, in that he starts out conservative. So he's converted at a D.L. Moody's conference where A.T. Pearson speaks. And Pearson was John Wanamaker here in Philadelphia, the department store maverick. He was the handpicked pastor of Wanamaker. And he goes and so excites young people that they have the student volunteer movement. So Pearson is pre-mill and he's conservative. And that's what then Speer is at the beginning of his tenure as general secretary. But the more that he goes, he gets impacted by the social gospel, and he also becomes aligned with his great buddy in the Methodist Church, John R. Mott. And Speer becomes the point person for every ecumenical endeavor the Presbyterian Church does at the start of the 20th century, from the Federal Council of Churches to the World Conference of Missions to the Wartime Commission to even the Plan of Union. And what's interesting along the way is that Charles Ehrman then becomes the chairman of the Committee on Foreign Missions. Machen is battling the establishment in the Presbyterian Church, and they want really not to make doctrine an issue because they will lose in regard to the numbers of the church. And Machen even says this in the concluding chapters of Christian Liberalism, in that if you are all about the numbers and you're all about adding new people to the church, then liberalism is a success. But if you're about fidelity to the Bible and about lasting results, then liberalism is a resounding failure. And to Erdman and to Speer, those are fighting words. And they had the mechanism and machinery behind them throughout this fight to win the battle. And Lefferts, Loscher says in The Broadening Church that no one person more affected and directed the theology of the Presbyterian Church between 1921 and 1936, which is virtually the period we're talking about, than Robert E. Speer. That's what he says directly in The Broadening Church.
You know, it's interesting, Danny, on that very point. I was just reading Longfield yesterday, and on page 187 over into 188, he includes this quote by Speer. But even before that, he speaks about Erdman and Speer. But Erdman, in particular, was the most loved Presbyterian. I mean, and so this is one of Machen's big rivals at Princeton, and then Speer. So it's not only the fact that these are the establishment, but they're also the most liked people out of all people in the Presbyterian Church. But here's what Speer wrote. These are Speer's own words, and this will connect us back, as you already connected us back to doctrine, the point of this particular chapter. Speer writes, "We Presbyterians and Methodists have no business being apart on questions of doctrine and polity. These things on which we differ are not things connected with the great vital purpose of the Church of God in the world. And when we have once decided what the purpose of the Church is, namely to do the work Christ sent us here to do, which is to preach and live his simple gospel and leave the result to him, we have no business to let the differences on unessential points delay the full accomplishment of that purpose."
Yeah, that's it. That's the great quote, because Machen is arguing in Christianity Liberalism, Presbyterianism for the whole world. He believes that Calvinism and the doctrines of grace are what is needed for the conversion of sinners. And here are these guys in leadership saying, no, we don't need, you know, we just need a trust in Jesus, whoever that Jesus might be. Now, what's fascinating again is that, so in 1925, Erdman becomes the moderator of the General Assembly. He steps down from the chair. He creates this commission to investigate, you know, Princeton Seminary. Well, who's the moderator in 1927 when this
Speer.
all comes to find? It's Speer. I mean, Machen,
he's on the committee, and then he moderates it.
What is Craig talking about that Machen was not a good quarterback? Machen is going, this is like the movie 300. Machen is going against the entire, you know, machine of the Presbyterian Church, and he's willing to die. You know, so I have an exact opposite read of Craig on this.
Sure.
Yeah.
Wow. Darrell, what do you think about Speer here as the background to this doctrinal point, this doctrinal indifference, where it's really a pragmatism at work, where numbers and influence are really what's important? I'm going to strip down everything else for the sake of Speer's words, the simple gospel, the simple gospel. which would remove all differences between even Presbyterians and Methodists.
I mean, he's a really remarkable figure in a way, because he's that well established for that long and has that kind of influence on the PCUSA. And for some reason, this is something I don't understand, even going back to the reunion of the old school, new school, and developments after that leading up to the Federal Council. I'm wondering, and I've done a little work on this, why the Princeton faculty weren't opposed seemingly to the Federal Council. Maybe they had shot a lot of their ammo on the revisions to the confession in 1903, but there's just a general progressivism in which all the Anglo-American Protestant denominations participate. And I think that Anglo-American character is important, that it's ethnic in a way. This is a time of a lot of immigrants coming to America, that they want to retain a Christian America, a WASP America, and for good reasons and bad reasons. I mean, I'm not just trying to taint them with some kind of white nationalist supremacy brush or something. But I mean, you could take it in that direction, but it's just sort of the way that the elite institutions in America are running, the mainline churches among them, and Speer is situated well, by the way, with the football analogy, he was a star tackle at Princeton on the football team. Why a tackle? How a tackle becomes a star unless you're, you know, I can't.
Taylor the one.
Purple people eaters or
Darrell, what do you think about the fact that the Cumberland Presbyterian Church comes back in 1906? And you mentioned Brian before.
Right.
And his roots from the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. And one of the amazing things is that when he was a young man, I think it was in 1887, the Cumberland Presbyterian Church said, to save America? To save the world, we must save America. In other words, it's the most Christian America declaration that you will ever read anywhere. And the fact was that Bryan, although he would be, we would say, theologically conservative, he also was a full social gospel person. Right. So it's this incredible merger then,
right,
in which your personal piety can be divorced from what the church is doing ecumenically in order to convert the world.
Right.
And I think that plays out.
Yeah. And the idea of doing good in the world and helping people both domestically and internationally, and not having to worry too much about the structures that we're using to do, I still think it's part of, I mean, dare I say, in some circles in the OPC, and we could talk about this off recording, but I mean, I'm not trying to raise any great suspicions, but I do,
sure.
I mean, I do have some concerns, but you know, I mean, the idea of supporting worthy causes in the world and the church doing that and lending its support, and then you sort of wind up doing it in the name of Christ. And then, well, if you can do that in the name of Christ, isn't that akin to preaching the gospel in the name of Christ? And then you do begin to blur the so-called individual gospel with the social mm-hmm. gospel. I mean, I could see how it would happen. And this is, again, where Machen stands out in a way, coming from a legal home, and his brother is an attorney, prominent attorney, his father was as well. And, you know, I don't know if he really thought it, studied law, read law, whatever, but lawyers do worry about procedures and policies and things that cross lines, and making sure you get your briefs in on time and make sure you have proper kinds of testimony, etc. And Machen was like that. And he's a stickler on procedure in a way that he's also a stickler on doctrine. I do think there's a kind of overlap between the two. But for whatever reason, American Protestants in the progressive era really kind of forget about those I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed in legal arrangements, whether in political or even ecclesiastical realms, it seems to me, because there's a larger work that needs to be done. I mean, you know, in the current climate, we have lots of alarm about certain injustices, and the idea that you have to take your concerns about those injustices to Congress and work it through the legislature and the deliberative body there. Well, who wants to do that? We know what we need to be done needs to be done. So again, there's a, I mean, I think the Protestant world was moving in that direction in the progressive era. And again, I wonder why more conservatives in PCUSA weren't worried about it, but Machen eventually did stand up. And there was plenty of opposition on matters of creedal revision and the like, but still could have been done, I think.
We're working or looking to a hard out, coming up ahead on a hard out. So that means we got to stop in a few minutes. So I got a couple quotes that I at least want to use as touch points that we could get looking on page 20 in Christianity and Liberalism regarding this. First off, the background, of course, all of this, modernism or liberalism, classic liberalism, we're not talking liberalism as just a relative term as it gets tossed around today for a whole host of things, but it really had escaped the academy and it infiltrated the church through a whole host through a whole range of means, in Sunday school materials, in the pulpits, and even in the religious press. And some of the doctrines that were being presented by classic liberals, people may have heard of or they're familiar with, but they were the universal fatherhood of God and the universal brotherhood of man. Very nice sounding things. You can write pop songs about these kinds of topics. It sounds great. But liberalism at heart really asserted that Christianity was a life and not a doctrine. In fact, it seems as if many classic liberals were opposed to doctrine in principle. But what Machen writes here on page 20, and this gets to the heart of the matter, he says, "But if any one fact is clear, on the basis of this evidence, it is that the Christian movement at its inception was not just a way of life in the modern sense, but a way of life founded upon a message. It was based not upon mere feeling, not upon a mere program of work, but upon an account of facts. In other words, it was based upon doctrine." Coupled with that is his frequent refrain. There are other quotes we could read. You can get to them if you read the chapter in page 25 and 27, I believe, where he frequently compares and contrasts life and doctrine. The two aren't opposed to one another, but he talks and emphasizes the fact that the supernaturalism enters into history, that Jesus Christ is the eternal Son of God come in the flesh, that he lived a perfect life, he died to pay the penalty for our sins, was buried in the grave, remained there for 3 days, and then was raised from the dead, not as an idea, not merely spiritually, but bodily and spiritually, as in by the Holy Spirit, to conquer death itself and to bring salvation for all of his people. That is so critical, as at least as I'm reading, that Machen is emphasizing that this is supernaturalism. Christianity is supernaturalism, and that's why liberalism, classic liberalism, which at heart is ethical teachings based on naturalism, why that is not merely a deficient form of Christianity, but is an entirely different religion. What do you guys think about that? And why is that so significant, I suppose, to Machen? And and how does it color his, you know, his mindset on the events to come?
Yeah, we could do, I imagine, months and months of pods on this. But so Machen, his activity during this period of time is just unbelievable, from writing The Origin of Paul's Religion to the Greek grammar to writing this to going everywhere. But that's interesting when you take a look at Origin of Paul's Religion, where he says in that book that the question is really looking at the origin of Christianity. And then at the same time, he was in the pulpit at First Presbyterian Church. And one of the sermons he preaches that you can find in God Transcendent is The Living Savior, which is basically his sermon on Matthew 4, 23 through 25. And so you actually get the really in reading Christianity Liberalism, you get the nice sense of this is further exegesis upon what he's looking at there and why he's arguing as he is. And there it comes out that Machen's saying, look, Jesus is not just some good teacher who persuades the disciples to follow him. This is the king. This is the promised one. And when he comes, he's promising a kingdom of redemption, not a school of ethics. And at the center of it is his own person and work, which is so contrary to what the liberals were saying. And so what has happened at the beginning of Matthew 4 and then Matthew 5 is the exact opposite of what the liberals are saying. And to Machen, they get the beginning of Christianity wrong, and then they get the middle of Christianity wrong, because if Jesus doesn't go to the cross, then Jesus is a failure as he appears to the disciple, because he's telling them, follow me and everything. And if it's left to their own works and nothing is done about sin, if the captivity of sin is not broken through his death and resurrection, then he's a failure. So how can you leave out the cross? And then Machen goes to the end and basically says, do you know what's happening in the Great Commission? It's that Jesus is telling his disciples to teach all that I have commanded. If you don't have any doctrine, which is based upon the historical work that's just happened, there's nothing to teach. So to me, it's like he was right on. I mean, and here's the thing, is that rather than me stumbling around and trying to put like to those documents together, he is so clear in his prose. His argument is so clean that you can retain it. I mean, there's nothing quite like reading Machen when he gets rolling talking about doctrine.
Yeah, and I would only add to that the kind of evangelical dimension to this, in that emphasizing the supernaturalism the way Machen does, he did have a following among fundamentalists, and tried to sort of keep them at bay in some ways. But, I mean, the fundamentalists could go to notions about the imminent return of Christ or the premillennial return of Christ, or kind of evidence of the work of the Holy Spirit in people's lives, whether it was charismatic or Pentecostal or just some lower level signs of that. And Machen seems to open the door to all that kind of supernaturalism. The more supernaturalism, the better, just as long as we don't have appearances of Mary or something. But Machen's really emphasizing the supernaturalism that's associated, as Danny just said, with the person and work of Christ, because it's not just about supernaturalism, because there's no other way of salvation unless it's a supernatural work of God. Human beings cannot save themselves. They cannot make themselves right with God. They can do all the good works in the world that they want to do and improve China, improve India, improve somewhere else, but that's still not going to cut it when it comes to judgment day. So to re the remedy for sin has to come from outside nature, and it has to be supernatural in that sense. And so Machen, could open the door to all sorts of supernatural stuff, but he's really wanting to go back to the supernaturalism of the incarnation and the deity of Christ, the Bible as being the word of God and authoritative, and the work of Christ on the cross and his resurrection as the atonement for sin. I mean, that is like the hub of his supernaturalism, and it kind of to people who may be experientially inclined, well, that kind of sounds boring. The Bible.
The emphasis on Historia Salutis.
I mean, we've heard that all the time. We just hear that all the time. Can't we have something a little bit more vital, a little bit more, you know, vigorous? And, but I mean, throughout, every time I go back to Machen, I was doing something on the virgin birth of Christ, I think. I can't remember what it was. And his argument for why the virgin birth is important is because of salvation. It's not to show the liberals are liberals and they deny this, but there's something way more at stake, which has to do with if Jesus doesn't have some kind of supernatural entry into the world and is tainted by sin, then we're toast.
Yeah. It's always both for Machen. Not only, as you mentioned, does salvation have to come from without. It's transcendent. It has to come from God. It's supernatural. But as you've emphasized there, it has to be in the world. It has to happen in time and space. And this is a thread, just to close us out. I know we've got to go. We really do. We've got a heart out here I'm trying to respect. But Van Til picks this up, which is why this is such a driving factor for Van Til and why he quotes from Christianity and liberalism in the New Modernism. So again, the New Modernism is what? It's the theology of crisis. It's crisis theology with Barton Brunner. And he's saying this is the New Modernism, as in, you know, it's 10 years later, but now look at how this has evolved. In 1962, with Christianity and Bartianism, just ripping off Machen's title entirely, but just replacing liberalism with Bartianism. And then he has an excellent conclusion to that whole book detailing why he is stealing this or providing a heavy homage to this book. And then I believe the copyright for A Case for Calvinism in 63, but it wasn't published till 64. He also has an entire introduction in that book where he's dealing with Carnell and then two liberals and writing a response because he thought Carnell's evangelical response to these two liberals in this particular series was inadequate. He writes A Case for Calvinism, and the introduction to that book also places Van Til's concerns directly in the historical vein of Machen's book, Christianity and Liberalism. And why? It's because Bart and these other two liberals later, but Bart especially, Bart doesn't have a problem with supernaturalism of a sort, but the problem with Bart is that Christ doesn't enter into history and accomplish redemption for us in time and in space. He does it in what Van Til calls Geschichte, or what Bart might call God's time for us, which is not our time. And so this is a problem that keeps repeating itself. But Christianity is a doctrine, but it's a doctrine because God acts in history, in time and in space, to accomplish salvation for his people. That's the core. If we want to use or steal Spears' term, the simple gospel, that's the simple gospel.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
But that's what's at the heart of it. That's why doctrine's so important. And you can read the rest of the chapter for more information. Danny?
Yeah. And cut me off here. I mean, if Daryl has to get it, but Machen says in this chapter that Christianity, it's a triumphant indicative. And that liberalism, they are in the imperative mode. Now, what's really fascinating when you think about this, so one of Van Til's fellow faculty members and OPC ministers, Paul Woolley, in the 1950s, gives an address in Grand Rapids. And and Woolley lived through this because Woolley was with Machen at Princeton in the 1920s. And Woolley said by 1925, because of Karl Barth, all everyone wanted to talk about was doctrine, and that the liberal contention concerning doctrine was already being refuted. So it's very fascinating when you look at Woolley and Van Til, because they take Machen to heart in that, yes, Christianity is a triumphant indicative, but because of that, there is an imperative, and the two go together. So the liberals were denying the indicative in making Christianity just a life and not a doctrine, but Bart ends up doing the opposite.
Right.
He makes Christianity a doctrine and wants nothing to do with his life. I mean, only 2 years later, he's living with his mistress in the same house with his wife, which he does for the next three decades. You know, how is that fidelity to the commands of Jesus Christ? You know, so you see here that Machen was together. I mean, and seeing what the Bible teaches about the doctrine and life going together.
Yeah. Amen. It's such an important point. These things keep repeating. It's sad, but I've said it many times, but to quote Samuel Clemens, history might not repeat itself, but it surely rhymes. You know, we get that time and time again. Oh, I'd love to keep talking, and we will. We'll do it in further episodes, other series. And Daryl, you're welcome back anytime. But we're talking Christianity
Thanks.
And liberalism. This was the chapter on doctrine. We're going to get into the next chapter, hopefully in a couple weeks. But thank you both for taking the time to join me and to talk about these things. We really appreciate you both, Danny and Daryl. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Camden.
You can find out more information online at reformedforum.org. We have all of our upcoming events, our courses that are available, including the free course on J. Gresham Machen, taught by none other than Daryl Hart himself. That's available on our website. It's also available at YouTube. Head on over to youtube.com/reformedforum. Please subscribe there. Help us convince the algorithm we're worth recommending. The all-important algorithm. We appreciate that, and I do want to thank everyone for listening and watching. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.